It's 9:06. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. As it's 9 o'clock on, it's the 9 o'clock hour on a Monday. Of course, it's time for all things political. We'll spend the next 53 minutes or so talking, reviewing the last week's worth of political news. And boy, howdy, there's plenty of it. Helping us to parse all of this information and discuss it, Tom Bevin, co-founder and executive editor of Real Clear Politics, and they have a website, realclearpolitics.com. You can check that out. Tom Bevin, good morning and welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, John. Thanks.
What was your top political story the last week?
Well, as you said, there's been a lot of news. Obviously, the two debates were fairly key. Obviously, the first one because of Rick Perry's meltdown, which generated a lot of publicity, and then this foreign policy debate that happened just on Saturday. Those two were sort of the biggest political stories, and also the story, the aftermath of Herman Cain's terrible week, which was the week prior, mostly. And the new round of polls showing Newt Gingrich sort of picking up steam and gaining support as some support slipped away from Cain after the sexual harassment charges were leveled against him. So those were kind of the two main political stories of the last week.
Okay, well, I want to get your take on the two most recent debates. But before that, I'd like to get your take in general on the number of candidate debates that the Republicans have held. There are a lot of debates. I would think that, and I know that the candidates want to get their message out and want to have FaceTime on television, but this is sort of a high risk reward kind of situation as we've seen, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, the debates were influential in the last cycle, but it seems every cycle now, I guess because of the way the news media operates, these debates are becoming more and more influential and important. And that's one of the things we cover in this new ebook that we have out. You look at Michelle Bachmann, her first debate sort of sparked her candidacy and at the same time really damaged Tim Pawlenty, that first debate where he failed to take on Mitt Romney. We've seen the debates have sustained Newt Gingrich after he was sort of left for dead back in June after his entire staff left him. And they've obviously hurt Rick Perry in a significant way, not just because of his poor sort of stylistic performances, but because of his answer in that debate in Florida about immigration, illegal immigration, and tuition for illegals in Texas. His support tanked after that. And now we're sort of seeing it again. Herman Cain has performed well enough in these debates to spark his candidacy. But you're right. I mean, this is one of these things. You talk to any of the strategists, the staffers, they hate these debates because they suck up all the time getting to these debates, preparing for them. And a lot of times they're not watched by that many people, relatively speaking. And they're kind of these shows that are put on for the pundit class who end up writing about them. And the old adage is you can't win a debate, but you can certainly lose it. And when something like what happened to Rick Perry on Tuesday happens, where it's this terrible gaffe and that little, well, in his case, it was 46 or 47 seconds, gets replayed the next day 100 million times. So now the broader public who didn't watch the debate, they didn't see anything else, but now most of the country knows about Rick Perry's brain freeze.
Well, and what about his comments on foreign aid and the little kind of kerfuffle that happened there regarding Israel?
Well, I think after his brain freeze, Rick Perry went out and did sort of damage control. He was on all the morning shows. He did David Letterman. He was doing interviews with anyone who would help him. The punditry sort of wrote him off as being done, dead, and gone. But in some ways, I think that might have helped him a little bit in the sense that he was playing up the idea of, I'm human and this was a human moment. And a lot of folks can sort of sympathize with having something on the tip of your tongue and not being able to remember it. In the foreign policy debate, the reviews were pretty positive for him. And in the sense that he was sort of the newsmaker in a good way. I mean, he was the one who sort of had this line about foreign policy, foreign aid should start at zero. Newt Gingrich agreed with it. Mitt Romney agreed with it. Despite the fact, to your point, it raised the question about, well, should Israel have to, you know, our great ally in the Middle East, should Israel have to start at zero and justify all the amount of aid we get to them? But again, I think that's probably from the Perry camp's perspective, that's at least they generate some positive news. They're not really worried about the Israel aspect of it. I mean, Perry actually finally came away from a debate with people saying, okay, the guy, you know, he acquitted himself fairly well, and he was sort of the newsmaker of the night, which is something that, you know, all these candidates covet.
Is Michelle Bachmann done?
I think she probably is. I mean, I hesitate to write off anyone in this environment where, you know, it's still so fluid, but it does look like her high water mark of her candidacy was the night that she won the Ames straw poll. Again, we have this ebook coming out. It came out on Friday. It's available now, and you can sort of download it. We go back through, and we have some really good stuff on some behind the scenes stuff on Michelle Bachmann's campaign. In fact, the day after she won the straw poll, she was Rick Perry got in the race and went to Waterloo, which is her hometown in Iowa, where she was born, and to speak at this event. Bachmann wasn't originally scheduled to go to that event. She decided at the last minute to go because Perry was going to be there. And her strategist came up with this great plan to welcome Perry to the race, with her going up there and ribbing him and trying to get under his skin right away, saying effectively, from one former cheerleader to another, sort of making fun of the fact that he was a cheerleader at Texas A&M, welcome to the race, you're a few months late. And they had this whole strategy mapped out to welcome him to the race and sort of rib him. But one of her advisors overruled the campaign manager, and it ended up not happening. And that night, Rick Perry sort of took command of the race and really sucked all the oxygen out of her campaign, and she really hasn't recovered since.
The phone number, if you'd like to join our discussion, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And there's a Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page that you can also leave a comment on, and we'll share that with the listening audience. My guest is Tom Bevin, co-founder and executive editor of Real Clear Politics. And as he's mentioned, there's a new e-book out called The Real Clear Politics Political Download, Election 2012, The Battle Begins. And you can find that at realclearpolitics.com, and it'll contain a lot of the information that we're discussing this morning. There are other political issues besides the GOP presidential race, but that seems to be that's certainly the most interesting of the political news. The other, a lot of the other stuff is sort of same old, Congress still can't get anything done, and we will talk about that. I'd like to get some callers' takes on the super committee. We'll see what comes of that. But to the presidential campaign, who has benefited the most from these debates? I've read some people, some comments. Of course, they're all over the board. Pundits are everywhere. But Mitt Romney seems to be the one who has benefited, simply because, and I hate to say it this way, he's messed up the least.
Well, that's true. I mean, one of the things about Romney is that it does show that experience matters in this environment, and that running for president, I mean, he's a much better candidate this time around than he was last time. He's shown that in the debates. He's managed to finesse, and quite frankly, I'm a little surprised that he's managed to get by without being attacked. You know, with all of these debates, to your point, and there's still a bunch left to come, so we'll see if that continues. But candidates have been reluctant to attack Mitt Romney directly. For the most part, he's escaped from these events relatively unscathed. So in that sense, he has benefited. But I would also say that, you know, Gingrich is probably the one. When you go back and you look at where his candidacy was. I mean, we detailed this in the book, but it was one of the more disastrous rollouts of any presidential campaign. I mean, back in May 15th, he went out to Meet the Press and attacked Paul Ryan, his plan as being sort of radical right-wing social engineering. And that was the start of his campaign. He'd only been in the race a week. And for him to sort of be able to sustain himself over time and rebound, in part because the other candidates, to your point, have messed up and it's been a process of elimination, and Gingrich is one of the only ones left standing. But I'd have to say Gingrich has benefited probably at this point the most, and clearly Rick Perry's benefited the least.
800-486-8655 is the phone number, 800-486-8655. We've got some people calling in with their take on the week's political news, and certainly plenty to talk about both nationally and in the state of Wisconsin. There are some issues that I would like to at least raise with the listeners for discussion. Let's go to the phones now, and we'll take Willem's call. Willem from Colfax, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I was just thinking that listening to the debates and to the level of the discourse and all that, I just think it's almost embarrassing to the things they're talking about, the things they're saying, this proposal about everyone starting at zero. I mean, it's sort of pandering to the Rush Limbaugh crowd, this sort of anti-intellectual, anti-reason approach to politics. You know, the founding fathers were men of the Enlightenment, men of reason, and that seems to be like out of fashion or something. We're just all appealing to this sort of emotional Joe Sixpack. I hate to say that because I don't have anything against regular folks or anything like that, but just the level of the debate seems to be, and they're always calling up the Constitution, but no one's ever bringing up the elimination of the Fourth Amendment or anything like that. They're always talking about, you know, the right to carry your guns and all these sort of things, but I just sort of disappointed in the overall level of, these are the best people we have to potentially be the most powerful people in the world. It's sort of embarrassing.
Tom Bevin?
Well, look, to a certain degree, there's something to that. I mean, going back to sort of the book a little bit, one of the stories of this cycle is about the people who chose not to run as much as the people who chose to run. Mitch Daniels, Chris Christie, these folks were highly regarded. Haley Barbour's another one, Mike Huckabee. These folks were, you know, highly experienced, highly regarded candidates who, for whatever reason, whether it was their family, whether it was, you know, the current job they have, whatever they were doing, chose not to run. And so you're left with a field that is probably missing some of the heft that it would otherwise, might have. So that being said, I do think there is, you know, the candidates that are out there now, getting to this issue of foreign aid, for example, that was raised. I mean, in this current environment, though, with everybody focused on the economy and the debt and the deficit, I don't know that that's a terribly unpopular position to raise and say, for example, well, why, you know, are we, let's justify every dollar that we're spending, whether it's on foreign aid or anything else. I don't know that that's necessarily an unreasonable position, to use the caller's language. So, but sure, there's something to that. I mean, these primaries are always a bit of a tussle and sort of, in some ways, appealing to the lowest common denominator, and we end up focusing on smaller issues and gaffes and whatnot. I mean, is Rick Perry's brain freeze, the biggest issue of the day, but it ends up making the most news. So there's a lot of that mixed in there as well.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll take some more phone calls. Still room for you if you'd like to get in. Thanks to Willem for his call. And we have some others who want to get on, but if you'd call right now, there's a spot for you at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can find the Kathleen Dunn Program Facebook fan page and leave a comment there as well. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 22 minutes past 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later on today on the Ideas Network, dignity is easily understood, but for many of us, extremely difficult to define. Yet when we do understand it, it can help us to resolve conflicts of all types. At Issue with Ben Marins after 5, the role dignity plays in our everyday lives. That's coming up later today on the Ideas Network. This hour, it's All Things Political. My guest, Tom Bevin, co-founder and executive editor of Real Clear Politics, and the co-author of the e-book, The Real Clear Politics Political Download, Election 2012, The Battle Begins. You can find that at realclearpolitics.com, realclearpolitics.com. With all of the focus on the various faux pas, slip-ups, brain freezes, misstatements and whatever that all the candidates seem to be prone to in these debates, it's pretty easy to see that happening when you're live and working from notes or note cards or whatever. Is there space for a dark horse candidate to come in late, having skipped all of the bloodletting? I mean, I guess you were talking about how the nature of the primary system forces people to talk to the base. I don't want to use the word pander, but they have to work to the base, and this is true both in the Democratic and Republican parties. Is there space here for a possible dark horse candidate to come in late? And you mentioned some of the names of people who said they weren't going to run. Is it possible that any one of these people could be drafted simply because everybody else they basically just destroyed each other?
Probably not at this point. I mean, we're into, you know, ballot access issues and getting on the ballot in these states. So I don't think there's a chance that, and especially, again, for someone to come in at this late date to be able to raise the money and put together any sort of infrastructure, even if it's just skeletal in some of these early states, and be competitive. I think we've passed that point, and we're now on to, if we want to talk about alternate scenarios, we can start discussing, again, this being sort of a long shot, but something happening, something going to convention, which is something we haven't seen in a very long time. If you have a situation where Mitt Romney ends up in a sort of battle against the anti-Romney candidate and can't really win, this thing drags on all the way to the convention, you could see a scenario where someone like a Chris Christie or a Mitch Daniels at that point is there's a brokered convention and someone else outside who hasn't been through the process ends up being nominated. Now that, again, it's a long shot. But in this environment, because of the way, Mitt Romney, you look at his poll numbers, he's at 22-25%, which means, 75-80% of the Republican voting electorate wants to choose someone else. And there's no indication of where his additional support is going to come from. because, if as these other candidates drop out through the process, it's unlikely that their votes or their support's going to swing to Mitt Romney. If anything, it's going to swing in the other direction. And so you can start to envision a scenario in which Romney can't win the required number of delegates, and you end up in August, late August, with a brokered convention. Now, that seems, anachronistic in this day and age, but it is something that Tony Blankley wrote about it last week, and it's something that people are sort of starting to at least envision, even if it's in a somewhat fantastical sense.
Let's go to the phones. We have a lot of people who want to talk about political news this morning, and that's a good thing. Let's start with Mila in Madison. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. So I wanted to pose this question with American politics the way it is. I don't think I need to really elaborate on that. Would now be a totally unreasonable time for America to start looking at third parties, or maybe even another electoral system that didn't require us to choose between just two candidates, like instant runoff, for instance? And is it fair, this is the same question, is it fair to permit the Republican Party to drag the American public through all these months of the lowest common denominator discussion that you that you had mentioned. Thank you.
What about, is this maybe the time for a third party, and who's helped or hurt by that?
Well, there certainly are a couple of organizations out there that are trying to marshal the idea of a third party. There's this group called No Labels, which Michael Bloomberg is a part of, which is trying to sort of appeal to the centrist, the independents, the middle ground on the other side of the ideologues. And there's also a new group that's funded by some pretty wealthy people called Americans Elect, and their idea is that, and you actually can find their ads, they're all over the internet, including on our site, because they're pushing this very hard. They had a press release, they had a press event at the National Press Club, I think last week or the week before, and the idea is where the public would actually nominate people and nominate who they wanted to see on the ballot, in addition to the Republican candidate and the Democratic candidate, and this group is going to spend $20 to $50 million to put that person on the ballot in all 50 states, so that they will have a third party choice. Obviously, it would depend on who that person is, who it would hurt more. But you would have to think that a third party candidate will probably it depends on who it is. It could siphon votes away from Obama. The other potential possibility here is if Mitt Romney is elected and you have a portion of the Republican base who's so disgruntled with that you could see a third-party challenge coming from the right, and that would be one of these Tea Party candidates, perhaps. And even if that person were to appear on the ballot and only get 3% or 5% in some of these states, that might make a difference, because it is shaping up to be a very close election, certainly not like 2008, more like 2000, where we're going to be back to talking about a handful of battleground states like Ohio, where it's going to be, you know, hand-to-hand combat, and could come down to, I mean, God forbid, some sort of, you know, a tie, effectively, and we could be back in the courts, it could go down to something like that. I don't think, however, that a third-party candidate is going to be viable this time around. The system really is rigged against it. We've been through sort of John Anderson and Ross Perot getting, 15-20% of the vote. But I just don't see it happening that way this time, in part because the issues that are at stake are so core and central to both parties' ideologies that I don't know that we'll find a third-party candidate who'll be able to track that sort of middle ground.
All right, Mila, thanks for the call. Let's go to Marshfield next and hear what Ann has to say. Ann, good morning.
Good morning. I would like people who have the public's ear, like the media, to encourage us, and I need to be encouraged also, to pay attention to our local, our state, and our House and Senate races, because I believe those elected people affect our lives more than the president does. And we tend to be single-issue voters because we get too confused on the multiple issues that are there. And so we just cancel out everything we don't understand and pick one issue. But we really need to pay attention to those races, because those votes, as in cast in Congress, not our votes cast, but the cast in Congress votes, affect our lives more than the presidential race.
And thanks for that. Tom Bevin, all politics is local, after all, when you get right down to it, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it makes a great point. I mean, there is this circus that is called the, Republican presidential nominating process, and then we'll go through another 4 months of the circus called the presidential election. And it does tend to dominate all of the media and all of the oxygen that's out there. But I think Ann made a great point, which is people do need to be, I think, engaged and paying attention to not only, local races, state races, and congressional races. Because as we found out, and this is one of the things that happened in 2010, which I think, regardless of what people's opinion of the Tea Party is, it did motivate a lot of folks who, most of whom, or at least plenty of whom, had never been involved in politics before, to not only go out and vote, but in many cases run And we saw a lot of folks with no previous political experience getting involved and putting themselves sort of out there. And in fact, a lot of them ended up winning and are in Congress now. And I think that's a good thing.
Ann, thanks for the call. Susan in Portage County, you'll be next. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning. My only question is it too late for an organization such as Jeb Bush's to get into the race? Everybody knows him. He'd beat all these Republican candidates right now. Interested in your opinion.
What about Jeb Bush?
I think that it probably is too late, again, because, as I said, there are ballot access issues now that have cropped up. We were only 7 weeks away from the first vote in Iowa. I mean, there are, you know, Sarah Palin's another one who has sort of universal name recognition and could potentially generate a lot of money in a very short period of time. Jeb Bush is a guy, and he's actually mentioned in our book. We spoke to a number of people about Jeb Bush specifically, and, you know, as much as he was put pressure was put on him to get in this race, that he constantly declined to entertain the idea in a serious way. So I don't suspect that predictions make fools of everyone, including me. But I don't suspect that Jeb Bush is going to be someone who's going to be participating in this race. Although, again, could you envision some sort of scenario, albeit a very long shot one, where we get to Republican convention in August and Jeb Bush's name comes up as one of the potential people? Absolutely, because he is very well respected within the party.
All right, Susan, thanks for the call. Let's flip this around a little bit. We've spent pretty much the first half of the program talking about the Republican presidential competition, and, well, that's where all the action is on the presidential side right now. But let's talk about President Obama, and as a way to get into that, I want to take Ken's call from Madison next, because I think that's what he wants to talk about as well. Ken, good morning, and go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah, hi, Ken. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I was just wondering why, you know, there's never any discussion about Obama's failure to, you know, generate jobs in the economy and how, you know, things like those shovel-ready jobs that were promised never came to pass. And that it's never discussed by, you know, what I would call, quote-unquote, leftist media. And people like Rush Limbaugh discuss things like this all the time, but yet one of your callers characterized the Rush Limbaugh program as being sort of unintelligent commentary, but yet, you know, that's the only place anyone can go to hear about things like that. So I'm just wondering why that's the case, and it seems to be never brought up by, you know, people like your guest and others in the leftist media.
Tom Bevin, there were some shovel-ready jobs. I just drove on some highway this past weekend that was a result of the stimulus bill. But let's talk about how President Obama and the economy are going to affect his fortunes going forward.
Well, right. I didn't mention Obama simply because, you know, it hadn't come up and we were talking about the Republicans. But, yeah, look, I think Obama is exceedingly vulnerable this election, and in part because of exactly what the caller mentioned, the economy and his failure to sort of create jobs. Now, I don't know that I think most people, and the polling supports that most people understand that this president inherited a mess. He inherited an economy that was contracting. But you know, at a certain point, it became his economy. I mean, he passed a stimulus package. He told the American people that with this $787 billion spending package that unemployment wouldn't rise above 8%, and it's been above 8% now for, you know, like 15 or 18 months. So he has, I think even by his own predictions and standards of his administration, not done the job, and I think he recognizes that, and he's now in a very tough situation where, you know, on the plus side of things, President Obama is going to probably, he's going to be up against a Republican who, regardless of who that nominee is, whether it's Mitt Romney or somebody else, who will come out of a sort of protracted primary process effectively broke, and Obama's going to have somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 or $600-700 million to spend against that person over the course of the 5-month general election campaign. That being said, I do think the president, you know, money's not everything in politics, and he is going to be running with the worst economic record in modern era, and that's something that, you know, we see the Republicans sort of talking about that a little bit now, but you can expect whoever the nominee is to get a lot more focused on that. That will be the central issue in next year's election, and the president is now settled on a strategy where he's going to be running against Republicans in Congress, blocking his jobs bill, but you can expect that that he is going to take a beating over the fact that he hasn't created jobs at the pace that he promised, and clearly the American people haven't been happy with the pace of job creation in the country.
Well, you've actually got some Democrats saying they're not going to support him, Democrats in Congress.
Yeah, that's right. There are a lot of Democrats who are, in the Senate particularly, who are up in red states, who are facing very, very tough elections. Again, this is an environment where you see, you know, 80%, 75% of people think the country's moving in the wrong direction. Congress's job approval rating is down in the teens, if not at one point. One poll has it at 9%. So the country is in a very, very sour mood and is ready to take out their anger on politicians in general of both parties. But again, you know, Democrats control the Senate and they control the White House. And certainly, you know, the presidential race, the president is in many respects sort of like the quarterback of the country, whether he gets credit for the victories and has to take responsibility for the losses, whether he's really was involved in it or not. And I think Obama is, again, he's going to be facing, I mean, a lot of folks consider him now to be the underdog, despite the fact that he's going to have, you know, $700 million to spend against a Republican candidate who probably is not going to be, you know, the strongest. But this is going to be a referendum on the president, no question about it.
Well, let's talk about the Senate. You mentioned it. I question whether anyone has control of the Senate, but that's a different discussion. Let's talk about the Senate. The Democrats have, what, 23, 24 seats to defend? The Republicans have only 10. That's really where the battle's going to be won and lost in this coming election, is it not?
It is, although, you know, there's going to be a fierce fight again for control of the House. I mean, Democrats think, certainly Democrats in the campaign arm of the House and Nancy Pelosi think that they have a good shot at retaking the House. Typically, when you get wave elections like the one we had in 2010, where, you know, one party suffers greatly, there's, over the next, you know, the next election, there are some folks who got elected by virtue of that wave who probably end up getting, you know, sent home 2 years later, and I think Democrats have their eye on a few Republican freshmen in the House that they think they can beat this time around. But you're right. I mean, Republicans are looking at the Senate, and it's a very favorable environment for them this time around in terms of the electoral landscape. And they've got senators like Mary Landrieu in Louisiana and Ben Nelson out in Nebraska and other places where they feel like there are you have very good chances of winning those seats, and Democrats have far fewer opportunities. I mean, they're focused on Massachusetts, for example, where they think they can retake that seat from Scott Brown and put in Elizabeth Warren. So, it's the battle for the Senate is definitely going to be a big part of next year's election.
You mentioned President Obama's massive campaign war chest. And whoever wins the Republican nomination is going to come out of this having spent an awful lot of money. What about third-party money? What about all the private money that's being spent both in congressional elections and what will likely be spent in presidential elections? Most of it is coming in on the Republican side. Talk a little bit about how that might impact the upcoming presidential election once we get past the conventions.
Well, that's a great point, John, and that's it is something that is going to be a factor. There are these super PACs out there now, and with the recent Supreme Court decision, they have the ability to spend unlimited amounts of money, and those folks will, especially on the Republican side, Karl Rove at Crossroads GPS, and some of these other, all the candidates now sort of have these super PACs that are somewhat affiliated with them that are spending money on their behalf. Those groups will help level the playing field. and we just saw, we went through this in Ohio with this referendum vote. You know, labor was pouring millions of dollars, and the Republican organizations were pouring millions of dollars. So we are going to see more ads this time around than we've ever seen before. There will be more money spent on this election than has ever been spent before in history. And depending on your perspective, some people think that's a good thing. Some people think it's a bad thing. So we'll have to wait and see. But, you know, all the money, having a lot of money is not necessarily the answer in politics. And we only have to look back to 2009. Again, this is something that we chronicle a little bit in the book. You know, John Corzine spent gajillion dollars trying to win re-election in New Jersey. He was in a three-party race, actually, and it didn't help him at all because the landscape, the environment was so negative for his party and his record that he could have spent an additional $100 million and it wouldn't have made the difference for him. So I think we have to be careful about giving too much credence to money. It certainly does matter and is influential, but you know, if the environment is such, if the electorate is in such a sour mood, that all the money in the world is not going to save some of these candidates, and it may not save the president.
All right, let's see. Here's an email from Cindy in DeSoto who says, Barack Obama has benefited most from the Republican debates. After seeing the Republican candidates, I can see that none of them can come close to the knowledge, skills, and morals of our President Barack Obama. Well, clearly an Obama supporter. Has President Obama benefited from the Republican debates?
I think he has, to a certain degree. I mean, you look at the polling, especially you go look in some of these individual swing states, and Obama's approval rating is underwater. His rating on handling the economy, jobs, deficit, spending is all very negative, down in the 30s, low 40s. And yet, when you ask whether how you look at how he runs against many members of the Republican field, he's tied or leading. And that goes to show sort of the nature of this election. You know, I always tell people the referendum that's going to take place next year is a two-part referendum, right? The first part is you look at Obama, do I want to reelect this man or not? And if the answer is yes, then you go ahead and vote for him, which most of his supporters will. But if the answer is no, then part B of the equation, you turn and look at, well, what's my alternative? And you know, provided that person, whoever that is, crosses a certain threshold of competence, people will go and vote for that person. But if they turn and look at the alternative and they deem the alternative to be inferior or unacceptable, then they'll turn back to Obama and say, gosh, I really don't like this guy, and yeah, he hasn't created as many jobs as he said he would, and the economy still stinks, but you know, I'm just not willing to, I'm going to stick with him because I don't like what my alternative is. And that's the challenge that Republicans face, and I do think that Obama has benefited from that. Now, we'll see next year. I mean, it's easy to look at all of these folks on the stage right now and say, you know, it's Barack Obama and the seven Republican dwarves. Well, next year, there will only be one Republican candidate who will be standing on stage next to Obama. And, you know, that person may, in that circumstance, look quite presidential and acquit themselves well. And if that's the case, then suddenly, you know, that person will end up looking as presidential as Obama, and that wouldn't be necessarily, that would hurt his reelection chances. So we have to wait and see how this is all going to play out. But I think in the short term, as all of these Republicans have been on stage squabbling against each other, yeah, he's benefited from it.
All right, we'll find out how that all worked out next November, I guess. Let's go back to the phones, and Appleton will talk to Mark next. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Just a comment from your guest saying that the Democrats control the Senate, and given the way the Senate Republicans have used the filibuster, which is almost on a daily basis and for everything, that's really not true. I mean, we have Senator Ron Johnson writing that somehow this is the Constitution, when in fact, if one reads the Constitution, two-thirds supermajorities were reserved for very rare things, such as declaring war and treaties. So saying that the Democrats control the Senate, that's no longer true. When the Republicans had the Senate, they insisted, they kept complaining about the lack of majority vote, but they no longer care about majority rule when they don't have the power.
Thanks, Mark. Well, I think I commented earlier, I don't think anybody has control of the Senate. Is the Senate actually manageable by either party, absent obtaining 66 seats?
I mean, that's, look, when Republicans control the Senate, Democrats filibustered, and you now need 60 seats to do anything in the Senate, right? You need 60 votes. I mean, that's a fact of life. It has been a fact of life for the last 10 years or so. So that's nothing new. I mean, the fact that Democrats have a slim majority in the Senate, does that make it harder for them to achieve 60 votes? Sure it does. I mean, you know, but it's also true that, you know, Harry Reid is the Senate Majority Leader, and part of the problem, part of the reason President Obama is running against Republicans for sure, but, you know, what's less reported is that he can't even get some Democrats in the Senate to support his jobs bill either. So Democrats don't even necessarily have, they don't have, aren't unified around the jobs bill now either. So, you know, I just don't know that that makes that much of a difference. I mean, whether, because Harry Reid is in charge and he is the Senate Majority Leader, for better or for worse, and that's just kind of, I mean, that's life in politics.
All right. Let's go to Richland Center next and hear what's on Mark's mind this morning. Mark, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I'm wondering why it is that in the Republican debates, Ron Paul seems to be marginalized in terms of his ideas, but the concern that he raises with regard to the all that's going on now with the Occupy Wall Street people and the focus on our monetary system, that doesn't become part of the conversation. But he's not exclusively left out of that, because on the other side of the aisle, Dennis Kucinich is advocating for monetary reform. And he's left out of the conversation as well. The problem that we have, according to Thomas Jefferson, is that the private issue of our currency cannot be trusted, and therefore it should not be in the hands of bankers to issue the currency. This is a worldwide phenomenon now, and the currency, having been issued as a debt instrument, can only actually grow the economy further into debt. So the understanding that we have as a population as to what is money isn't making it into the conversation, and that's a serious problem, because you cannot grow yourself with a debt-based monetary system anything other than into further debt.
I want to hold, Tom, I want to hold your response to that. We're going to take a break because I want to make sure we got that call in before the end of the program, and we're getting there. But well, let's talk about Ron Paul and some of the other candidates that we didn't mention. John Huntsman would be another one, and I'd talk about them. Ron Paul seems to, there's a common complaint among his supporters that he's ignored by the media, and when you take a look at it, it may in fact be true. But let's talk about Ron Paul in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. It's All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:51. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Next hour, we'll be talking about the Obama administration's announcement of their five-year plan for offshore oil drilling. This took place last week. It calls for opening new areas in the Gulf of Mexico and Alaska, but bars development along the east and west coasts. Next hour, I'll have a pair of guests to talk about what's going to change and what it means for people and wildlife living in the affected areas. That's coming up next hour here on the Ideas Network. This hour, it's All Things Political, and my guest is Tom Bevin, a co-founder and executive editor of Real Clear Politics and co-author of the e-book, The Real Clear Politics Political Download, Election 2012, The Battle Begins. It came out on Friday. You can download it from realclearpolitics.com, realclearpolitics.com. Okay. Tom Bevin, we had a caller who said, well, Ron Paul and his ideas largely being ignored in the media. He was talking about monetary policy and how even Dennis Kucinich is calling for changes. But let's talk about Ron Paul and his candidacy. Why can't he seem to get any traction?
You know, it's an interesting thing, because if you look at where the Republican Party is now, where the country is now in many respects, with the formation of the Tea Party and all of the focus on debt and deficit, Ron Paul has really moved the issues. I mean, the folks are a lot closer to him now than they were 4 years ago, talking about things like auditing the Fed and a lot of the things, even on foreign policy. I mean, Paul's sort of a more of an anti-interventionist, isolationist, if you will, But even now, you saw this foreign policy debate, folks, Republicans are talking about bringing troops home, disengaging from the wars and not nation building in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. So, again, have moved a significant way in Ron Paul's direction as far as issues go. But as far as his candidacy goes, you know, he has this strong core of support, 8 to 10%. It's about the same as it was last time around. He's able to raise enough money to be, you know, involved in this race, but he never seems to really make a dent. I don't necessarily think it's from – I think his supporters do have somewhat of a beef with the fact that the media perhaps doesn't give Paul the respect that he deserves. But on the other hand, they don't ignore him. He has been part of all these debates. He has gotten plenty of time to air his views. He does have enough money to run ads, make his case in the same way that other candidates do. And you look at last time around, for example, you look at a guy like Mike Huckabee, who started out as an asterisk in the polls and built his way up and ended up winning in Iowa. Well, Ron Paul has certainly had every opportunity to do that as well. It's just his viewpoint, while the Republican base is certainly sympathetic to a lot of his views, I think he just continues to sort of exist outside of the mainstream of the base of the Republican Party, so that he can't really expand beyond his 8 to 10% that he's getting this year that he got last time around. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword for Ron Paul. I mean, he has influence in the debate, but again, he's still not a factor in this race.
All right. Excuse me. Mark, thanks for the call. I just wonder, we talked about the congressional races earlier. I wonder how if there will be any impact in the upcoming congressional races from the redistricting that's happened. And in a lot of cases, the redistricting has been done in Republican-controlled legislatures in states across the country. What kind of effect will that, if any, have on the next congressional round of elections?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, this redistricting stuff in some states, is still going on, so we don't have the full picture. We're based in Chicago, and Illinois has gone through just it's a democratically controlled legislature down here, so it's been a very contentious effort, redistricting effort here, redistricting efforts in California and Texas and other places. So I don't know, and this is not my area of expertise, so I don't want to speak out of school, but I'm not sure exactly what sort of impact it is going to have. Again, I would say that Republicans feel confident that they're going to be able to maintain their control in the House. But on the other side, Democrats feel like they have a pretty good shot of winning the, 22, 25 seats necessary to retake control. Again, in part because they feel like that some of these Republican candidates that were elected in this wave of 2010, are now vulnerable to being ousted again because they haven't, necessarily, after the wave recedes, things sort of go back to the mean, and in a lot of these districts, Democrats feel like they have a good chance of retaking those. So we'll see what happens, but I don't know that we know the full impact of redistricting just yet.
We're just about out of time, and I wanted to get this in here. What effect, if any, do you think the Occupy movement is going to have going forward? Can they duplicate what the Tea Party did in the last round of elections?
I don't think so, in part because I don't think that the Occupy protests have the same sort of focus and drive. It's not totally clear what they're after and what they want. I think they probably hurt their cause with some of the violence and other stuff that's gone on in some of these cities. We see these reports on the front page about, crimes happening or vandalism or what have you. And, for the average person who's not really following this stuff, they look at that and they think, oh, well, these people are out of control. I think it does more hurt to their cause than good. So that being said, I mean, I think the public in general does sort of sympathize with the idea that, Main Street is hurting and Wall Street is not and has, in fact, even gotten, richer and is thriving more now than ever before. That was in some ways what fueled the Tea Party. That's where the overlap is. The Tea Party started because of the bailout of Wall Street, the TARP program that was initiated under President Bush and Secretary of Treasury Hank Paulson. So there is some overlap there, but I just don't know that that it's going to become the same sort of political movement and force that to have an impact next year as the Tea Party had in 2010. And we don't know how much of an impact the Tea Party is going to have in 2012, but it's still that's still to be determined.
All right, well, we'll have to leave it there because we're out of time. Thank you so much, Tom Bevin, for being my guest this morning. Appreciate your expertise.
All right, John, thank you.
Tom Bevin is a co-founder and executive editor of Real Clear Politics. He's the co-author of the e-book, The Real Clear Politics Political Download, Election 2012, The Battle Begins. That's just out and available at realclearpolitics.com. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning, on-air production by Chrissy Pease. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR.
Support for WPR comes from Milkweed Editions, publisher of Montana 1948, as well as American Boy, the new novel by Milwaukee author Larry Watson. Both are available now for the holidays at local bookstores or at milkweed.org.
The deadline to enter Wisconsin Public Radio.